Sometimes events happen in London that were really, really important for the city, but not as important for the country as a whole. And because of this, when people write down the history of the era we're going through, these events in London often end up just becoming small footnotes, a sentence here or there, briefly mentioning things and running on with the larger narrative. I'm saying this because by studying events in London around 1493, this huge growing city with its massive migrant population, you quickly get a perfect microcosm of the politics of Henry VII's early reign. From London's point of view, the geopolitical realities of Henry VII's European relations were brought to life in a series of events that took place on their doorstep, from massive celebrations to a bloody riot, from salacious gossip about a cross-dressing prostitute to accusations of jury rigging. The city was to see upon its streets events that were being dictated by people far away play out in incredibly small detail, where everybody seemingly had a hidden agenda. Everybody had a secret axe to grind. And at its heart, there's a fortune of money. London's merchants and the need of London mercantilism was driving all of what was going on in the city. As this podcast endlessly keeps repeating, if you really want to know what's going on in the past, follow the money. And the money will take us to some interesting places. Hi there, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, a podcast dedicated to telling the complex, intricate, and fascinating history of this ancient city from the perspective of the residents, giving us a chronological narrative as we break the majestic tale down into bite-sized chapters. We have reached the early 1490s. Henry VII is on the throne and has an heir called Prince Arthur, but his regime is still incredibly fragile. London had to cope with the implications of that. Welcome then to this 178th chapter of this story of London, The Young Man from Cologne. So we're going to begin this chapter with a small, salacious story. There's one set deep in the heart of London, on Thames Street to be precise. And as I tell this story, please keep in mind, this is one of my favourite kinds of stories, you know. It's a story about a historical event that was so quiet, so mundane, you have no idea how deep it can suddenly take you. It's like a small puddle of black water on a footpath. You stride towards it knowing the water's only an inch or so deep, and you don't see the hidden manhole cover that's been exposed, and you're taking an innocent step and suddenly you're in over your head. It's one of those stories. So exactly when this story takes place, we're not 100% sure. Based on materials and justifications I will give later on, I'm going to say it takes place in 1493. But technically it could be a few years either side of that date, and this is me choosing to put it at that date. I have reasons for my choices, and I will explain them later, but it is imperative, dear listener, that you know that these are choices. Throughout everything I'm about to say, the narrator will give you a cracking story, but the historian in me will keep whispering to you that you are encouraged to have some doubt and make up your own damn mind about what exactly happened. Now, this is a story about a young man called Herman Ring. Herman was a resident of London, but not only was he not born here, he was a man who capitalised upon his foreignness. He was today what we would call a German, only we're talking about a time when Germany didn't exist. Back then it was a wild collection of small nations, principalities, bishoprics and more, and was known as the Holy Roman Empire. Herman was in London, you see, as a representative of that region and of his home city of Cologne. But more than that, he was a very privileged member of the community of Germans and men from Cologne in London. You see, Herman was a Hanse. Now, that Hanse, or the members of the Hanseatic League, were a state within a state, based over in the region around the Baltic Sea and the Eastern North Sea. This was a conglomeration of German merchants and merchant towns. They were extremely powerful trade alliance in Northern Europe, and their wealth and their monopoly of goods and trade to these regions made them men who had power. Not power just in terms of cash, but also the power coin could buy them. Political power. And hence, the Hanse merchants of London lived then a life of luxury and protection. They had a whole section of the city down by the River Thames, the Stahlhof, or Steel Yard, that belonged to them alone. They ran their own affairs, and within the walls of this grand compound, the Hanse elected their own leaders and had for centuries been a pivotal part of London's social fabric, alien yet recognised in the city, foreign yet reconciled. Herman was one of these major Hanse merchants. In the early 1490s, he was one of the 16 major merchants of the Steelyard. That placed him above dozens of other minor traders. In London terms, he was a shark. He was a major player. This man, quite young man, was connected from a powerful family back in Germany, and he's been groomed for larger things within the Hanse organisation. And yet, for all of that, life had clearly thrown him a curveball. Because here and now, in 1493, when we tell the story, Herman found himself locked up in one of London's many jails. We have to assume it was Newgate. And if so, then this man of his wealth was possibly being kept in the master's ward, the side of the prison used for prisoners who could afford their own food and accommodation. And he was having to write to the Chancellor of England, the Archbishop of Canterbury, John Morton, for something called a writ of certiorari, which, if granted to him, would have his case transferred from the jurisdiction of the Sheriff of London to the royal courts overseen by the Chancellor. And because this is what he wanted, in his letter, he explains to the Chancellor how he ended up in prison. And this is a hell of a little story. Herman, he says, was in the Steelyard, busy packing up merchandise to transfer to sell abroad and being all German and merchanting, when suddenly a young English woman called Joan White approached him. Now, Herman was very specific when describing Joan. In the letter, he said she was a, quote, single woman, unquote. Single woman, one word. This term is apparently 16th century London slang. It means prostitute. So very quickly, he is saying he was approached in the Steelyard by Joan White, the professional sex worker. So the encounter between them is Herman Ring was minding his own mercantile business when Joan White, who he goes on to describe as, quote, a misliving woman, unquote, promptly offered herself to him, quote, to be at his commandment, unquote. Now, Herman is shocked, shocked, I tell you, at her, quote, boldness, unquote. And he said he didn't trust her, and he told her to go away. Joan White refuses to leave him. And so, fine upstanding pillar of the Hanse community that he was, Herman ordered one of his servants to whip Joan. A couple of times, maybe three, at which point she finally departed the Steelyard, possibly somewhat shocked at the assault. Herman had made it clear that Joan was not to be taken seriously as a witness, however. He included in the letter something he had heard about her, supposedly from her own confession in the grounds of this case, which he swears to the Lord Chancellor was taken, quote, in writing before credible persons, unquote. In this confession, Joan White had said she was used to dancing and, quote, making revel in her master's house, sometimes in men's clothing, and sometimes naked, unquote. Gosh, what a lewd and an immoral woman. Not like the good, young, upstanding Hanse merchant. No, honestly, Chancellor. Well, then followed, according to Herman, was an elaborate sting operation, a con job to fleece him of money. Soon after he got rid of Joan, suspiciously soon after to him, Joan White's master, a man called Stephen Reigate, hurried to the Steelyard. Herman specifically called him a, quote, needy man, unquote. And that's slang for somebody who wants more or greedy, and there's something sly about it. And he leaves enough innuendo in the accusation that Joan had danced naked or in men's clothing at Reigate's house to suggest that Stephen Reigate is her pimp. More than that, he was a troublemaker with designs to, quote, make me lose money, unquote. So, according to the letter, Reigate turned up at the Steelyard and demanded to know why Joan White had been whipped. Herman had explained the situation. Reigate simply didn't believe him and refused to accept that she had approached Herman. Herman told him to get stuffed. Unhappy at the answer, Stephen Reigate started a legal case, an action of trespass, with the Sheriff of London alleging that Ring had abducted Joan White and he was asking for £20 worth of damages. When summoned to the Sheriff's Court, Herman said he had, of course, pleaded not guilty. But that meant a trial had to be had. Now, as a member of the Hants, Herman was entitled to a jury de maditati lingali, which meant it would be composed of equal measure Englishmen and Germans. And yet, when the case came to trial, Herman was found guilty. Not, he said to the Chancellor, because he was guilty. He wasn't. Oh, no, no, no. The only reason the jury of Englishmen, oh, and some of his own countrymen, found him guilty was because Stephen Reigate, the pimp, had employed, quote, great measures and labour, unquote, which was a euphemism for bribery and intimidation. And as such, this, and only this, was the reason why the jury voted to convict him, doing so, quote, not fearing God nor shame of the world and contrary to all the truth, unquote. This intimidation and bribe jury, he said, had ruled that Herman was guilty of trespass, and they said he had basically kidnapped Joan White and then whipped her, and he'd been ordered to pay £3 in damages plus all legal costs. However, the judge of the court did not immediately pass sentence. Rather, as Herman's letter states, the judge suspected there was more to the story. Quote, having information of the truth of the matter and the willful perjury of the said jury, unquote, the judge chose to delay judgment until he had more time to discover what was actually going on behind the scenes. Herman had felt relief at this. And then the City of London had started to investigate, slowly, painfully slowly. And in the meantime, he was locked up. And this was why he was now writing this petition to the Chancellor of England asking for a writ of certiorari. Clearly, it's a hell of a story and there's a lot going on here. And I will come back to Herman's petition letter later on. Keep in mind that letter he wrote is the only account of the events that happened. We do not have Stephen Raymond's account of things, nor his answer to the accusations he'd bribed the jury. Nor do we have records of Joan White's account of events. Nor any written proof that a confession to dancing naked or in men's clothing even existed. There's a lot to say about Herman's case because a lot of what he wrote in that letter doesn't hold up very well in light of other evidence. But for now we're going to leave it, stick a pin in it. Because to understand why a case involving a German merchant in London is something important, you have to understand the context. You have to understand what's going on in and around this case in London. And it's a bit complicated. The backdrop to all of this is simple. By 1490, Henry VII had been on the throne for about 4.5 years. He was king, accepted by all. Well, maybe not everyone. As we've seen with the Battle of Stoke we covered 2 episodes ago, there were those who claimed allegiance to the old cause of the House of York, who had flocked to the banners flown by a young boy who claimed to be the Earl of Warwick. So there was dissent, because Henry VII was king, but there was a deep flaw in his kingdom and a crack in the security. Both at home and above all abroad, there were those who believed not only was he a usurper, he was vulnerable. That he could fall from power as easily as he had taken it. We'd already seen one battle over this. So right now, regardless of whatever else was going on, Henry VII is a man who is having to make like a royal swan. Graceful, powerful, king of all he sees above the surface, but below, hidden out of sight. His legs are kicking furiously to keep things looking elegant. This metaphor will be repeated many times during the Tudor age. Henry VII was engaged in a political death match, and the future of his reign and the inheritance of his young son, Prince Arthur, Prince of Wales, hung in the balance still. It's easy to forget just how much Henry worried about this, but he did, and as we will see, it will dictate his international political actions and his political acts back in home. And to understand why Henry VII was so nervous, we need to leave London just for a little and look abroad at just what was going on in the nearest parts of Europe, at what England's neighbours were up to that was driving instability back here in England. So back a few years ago in 1487, just after Henry had crushed the rebellion around the fake Duke of Warwick, Lambert Samuel, Henry's old ally, Duke Francis of Brittany, the man who'd given him exile for years back when he was in the political wilderness and hiding out from Edward IV and Richard II, had died. Duke Francis's heir was a 12-year-old girl, his daughter Anne. And while all this was going on, King Charles VIII of France had invaded Brittany, trying to reclaim for France the long independent duchy. Before his death, Duke Francis begged King Henry for help. And as French troops rampaged across Brittany, the future of this long, useful polity, whose independence from France had been a boon for England several times in the past, now became a political issue at home. Parliament had voted the money to provide an army for Henry to go to France to fight for Brittany's defence. But Henry VII had merely pocketed that cash and done nothing of consequence to help his old ally. The young Duchess Anne ended up being besieged by Charles, and rather than surrender, she agreed to marry King Charles, thus ending any violence and transferring the Duchy of Brittany to the French crown. France had won. Brittany had been restored to France. King Charles of France had just pulled off a flanker. But in doing this, he had to make a hasty wedding to the Duchess Anne. As to kind of drop his existing fiancée, to whom he was engaged to marry at some point, and she happened to be the daughter of the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian Habsburg. And Maximilian Habsburg immediately hits the roof to see his daughter so badly treated, and would therefore wanted revenge. Meanwhile, the barons of England were up in arms about Charles VIII's winning, mostly because it meant that Brittany was lost to France, and things were generally running very high. Parliament voted more money for a confrontation with the French. This time Henry VII felt kind of obligated to go to war. And so an English army was prepared and launched to go to war with France in October 1492. Henry's force was actually quite large. This army, which arrived in Calais, that port that remained England's one foothold in Europe, the tiny sliver of the once great Angevin Empire, and whose upkeep was paid for mostly by the Staple faction of London merchants. Henry's army was made up of 25,000 infantry and around 1,600 cavalry, more than enough to give the French one hell of a punch to the face. Thus arrived, the English soldiers marched out of Calais to besiege Boulogne. The plan was to be joined by a Germanic army under the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian. But when they got to Boulogne, Henry VII got word from the Emperor that he was really sorry, he was unable to send an army. He's, you know, busy with the Hungarians, I believe. Henry VII may have had a massive army at his heels, but it was late in the campaign season, and he decided he'd rather make peace with King Charles of France. The lieutenant of Calais, Giles de Bouny, then travelled out to meet King Charles at his headquarters in a place called Etaples. And there he presented the French king with English demands. And the English demands were painfully simple. Henry VII wanted cash. Loads of cash. I mean, enough cash to shore up his regime for years. Henry VII wanted to be bought off. And the French were willing and able to buy him off. As such, the eventual agreement between King Henry and King Charles, which became known as the Peace of Etaples, was very, very favourable to Henry, even if it was seen by many as a simple affront to national honour. The Peace of Etaples agreed that King Charles would keep hold of Brittany, but that he would pay King Henry 620,000 gold crowns in exchange for him to be fine with it. And it also said he'd pay an additional 125,000 gold crowns as an arrears for the pension that Louis XI had granted to Edward IV when he got paid off. And from now on, the new English king would now receive an annual pension worth about 25,000 gold crowns per year. That was a fortune. Henry VII gave his consent to this agreement and turned his army around and headed back home very happy. I mean, he was rolling in it now. That was a very neat and very profitable little campaign, you must agree. Well, we don't have to agree, because certainly people at the time didn't. The nobility of England who had joined the expedition to France were certainly not impressed. I mean, they'd had turned up hoping to win back long-lost territory from France. That's the excuse anyway. I mean, if that didn't happen, they could at least have collected loads of plunder from rampaging all over the French countryside. But now they were returning to Calais and they were empty-handed. I mean, the king had done well out of this. What about them? Added to this, the Holy Roman Emperor was less than pleased. He had his own axe to grind with the French now, and now England, his supposed ally, was basically being paid off by a fat French pension. Oh, no. No, he was furious. And behind all of this, you see, both he and King Charles of France had this ace up their sleeve they could have used against the English king. And we know that because of a specific section in the treaty. That piece of Etaples contained a remarkable clause that had a significant impact on a boy named Perkin Warbeck. And Perkin Warbeck's story is one we're going to have to talk about. You see, someone out there had a good idea. And that idea was to find someone of the right age and the right build, a young man in appearance who could impersonate Richard, Duke of York, the younger of the two princes in the Tower, whom they claim had escaped. And their choice was a young man we today now know was called Perkin Warbeck. The precise origins of the plot that brought Perkin Warbeck into the arena as a Yorkist pretender do remain obscure and uncertain. But it does seem at the earliest stages, he appeared at Cork in the autumn of 1491. And his acceptance there as a pretender to the throne was the first overt action in the unfolding of some kind of conspiracy. We know Margaret of York's going to be involved. And pretty soon, right now, at this point, we're sure Charles VIII of France was implicated. And it does seem that the French king had intended to use Perkin Warbeck as a weapon to use against Henry VII should his participation in Franco-Breton politics become too inconvenient. Warbeck, assuming the guise of Richard, Duke of York, rightful heir to the throne, could be used by the French to have him designated King Richard IV of England, and that would have caused Henry VII real issues, genuine ones. And it was part of this campaign that Perkin Warbeck turned up in Cork in 1491. Please note, his reception was somewhat cool. Clearly, Warbeck wasn't going to secure the same support from the Irish lords that Simnel had received in 1487. And by 1492, he was looking to move elsewhere, and of course, at this point, he ends up returning towards the French, where Charles VIII received him as a prince with appropriate honours. But then, Henry VII's diplomatic negotiations, which ended in November with the Treaty of Etaples, included this one item that said Charles VIII would not aid any of Henry VII's rebels. As such, Perkin Warbeck's stay in France was now over. What is he to do? Well, now he turned to Margaret of York, who was over in Flanders. I won't go into her full relation in this. I mentioned it two chapters ago. And Margaret of York found she had no difficulty in recognising young Perkin as her nephew. Margaret could now train up Warbeck and prime him with recollections of Edward IV's court and Yorkist family memories. And because of this, Perkin Warbeck now found himself under the protection of Margaret of York's extended in-law family, the Archduke Philip of Flanders and his father, the Emperor Maximilian, who is now on bad terms with Henry VII, and he now had a weapon to use against him. Henry VII really wanted to deal with Perkin Warbeck. He knew about him, he knew about this risk, his intelligence was good enough, and so he tried desperately to neutralise it before it became a problem. He sent envoys over to the Archduke, begging them to hand the kid over. But the Archduke and his council, they just evaded the issue by saying, you know, technically the Archduke has no power to interfere on Margaret's affairs. So this issue just continued and festered. This brings us right back to London, right to our doorstep. How? Well, remember, London is the centre of English trade and has the strongest mercantile interests in the whole kingdom. And behind it were the men who funded the mercantile interests. So you had people like the Mercers' Company, and they were running a guild within a guild, the Merchant Adventurers, an alliance of merchants who held the monopoly at this time for trade to Flanders. So let's look back to how they were seeing events across Europe from their point of view. For the Londoners, the years 1490 and 1491 had been difficult because the Channel and travel to the Low Countries was becoming increasingly unsafe. Henry VIII's support of Brittany against France had led to there being a war, but while no armies were marching against each other, ships were sailing, piracy was going through the roof. And at the same time, over in Flanders, there was a civil war against Emperor Maximilian, led by a man called Philip of Cleves, who was running a bunch of very ruthless pirates out of the port of Sluis. So the merchant adventurers of London were trying to avoid all this violence and simply send their ships over to the major fairs in the Low Countries taking place at this time. And they were doing so, but not without considerable hazard and risk. In the winter of 1490 to 91, for example, two ships set off from London carrying an array of goods from the merchant adventurers, the George Cobham and the Griffin. And they filled them with armed men as well before they went. But still, misadventure happened. The Griffin was burnt over in Zealand while riding at anchor, and the return journey of the George Cobham was delayed. Trade and profit was being lost and threatened. And just while this is going on, Henry VII then starts preparing for his invasion against France, and everybody in London does cough up cash to help the king, and that includes the merchant adventurers. But while this was going on, we do know that members of the merchant adventurers had begun to make rather discreet inquiries to find out if they would be able to sail safely to the giant fair of Bamis, which was held between August and October of that year, and if the nearby towns of Antwerp and Middelburg could guarantee their safety. These Londoners were ignoring all the geopolitics going on around them, focusing with the simple determination of men who were insistent upon making money. They decided, ignoring everything else, they'd make the trip, and it was so worth it. The ships which sailed from London to that fair saw 83 mercers ship over 6,428 bolts of cloth and 215 bolts of double worsteds. That was basically 40% of all the exports from London that year. Now, it wasn't all plain sailing. We know that authorities in Antwerp arrested some Englishmen who got into fights with the linen dealers over there. But the run to the Bamis Fair I'm mentioning now as evidence that for many merchants in London, regardless of what was going on in the world of geopolitics, trade simply had to flow. So with that in mind, along comes 1492. Relations between the Emperor Maximilian and Henry VII was good, which pissed off the pirates in Sluis. Henry was supporting Maximilian against his rebellious subjects in Sluis, and Maximilian then allowed ships from the Low Countries help Henry across the Channel to invade France that October. In that spring, because of the good relations between Henry and the Emperor, the king had finally licensed the merchant adventurers to use ships for mercantile purposes, and he even provided royal ships to protect the fleet on their way to the Easter Fair at Bergen op Zoom. It sailed from Dartford in May, and the premier ship of the merchant adventurers, the Anne of Orwell, was filled with armed men and loads of merchandise. However, the sheer cost of getting all these special licenses and paying for the extra security was now straining the unity of this desperate band of merchant adventurers. They had hoped the king would allow them a discount on their customs duties because of the expenditure they were paying for the war and for running trade during a war. And in October 1492, the governor of the merchant adventurers, a man called Pickering, got a notable diplomatic achievement on behalf of the adventurers, whereby he secured an exemption from taxes over there on ships passing through Zealand waters to help finance Maximilian's war against the rebels at Sluis. And this all was boding well, because in the same month of October, Philip of Cleves was defeated at Sluis by Maximilian's men with support of the English. But then the king had laid siege to Boulogne on the 18th of October, received peace proposals just 9 days later, and then signed that peace treaty on the 3rd of November. The king returned to London. The stapler, John Tate II, who was master of the Mercers that year, was amongst the London citizens and lords who welcomed back their victorious king with the usual wild celebrations on the city of London. However, that treaty meant that the brief period of good relations between Henry and the Emperor Maximilian was over by the end of 1492. And it's now that that new Yorkist pretender, Perkin Warbeck, who had appeared in Ireland in 1491 and now moved to France because he was being expelled, he reached Malines in the Low Country in early December, where he was welcomed enthusiastically by Margaret of York. And this was to have an impact on London's trade at once, since the king couldn't get the boy out of Flanders. Almost immediately, London felt the full effect of Henry's response to the threat posed by Perkin Warbeck. On the 5th of May, 1493, the king ordered that henceforth no goods were to be imported from or exported to the lands under the control of the Emperor Maximilian or Duke Philip without a license he issued personally. And he wasn't going to issue a license as long as Perkin Warbeck remained on the scene. In July 1493, at the same time that Henry's ambassadors were unsuccessfully trying to convince Maximilian to kick out Warbeck, the governor of the English merchant adventurers, the man running them abroad, a man called John Etwell, with support of the city of Bruges, and this city was actively seeking a share in the English cloth trade to promote its dying commerce, secured a safe conduct for the adventurers so they could bypass Sluis without any pirates bothering them. With this in mind, they then went to Henry VII for his approval in order to be able to use it. And Henry VII's answer depended upon how things were going with the king's ambassadors to Flanders. The merchant adventurers of London were desperate for news, and with rather a lot of arrogance, the adventurers approached Sir Reginald Bray and Lord Chancellor Morton to find out what's the king's intention, sending a large delegation of 15 men. Sir Reginald Bray was not impressed with their arrogance and sent them off to one of the collectors of customs for their answers. The collector told them that the king would allow no ship to enter or leave the port of London for the Low Countries. That was it. There was a trade war, there was an embargo, and you boys will obey. However, what had begun to annoy the merchant adventurers and all the traders of London was that this ban did not apply to foreigners who had licenses to import and export goods from London. And by foreigners, this meant the Hanse merchants. And so by 1493, 4 months into this trade embargo, the city government of London was becoming seriously alarmed at the duration of this trade war. Over in Bruges, the headquarters of the English Nation of Resident Merchants, their offices were boarded up. And here in London, warehouses were piled high with wool and cloth ready for export, gathering dust. In response to this growing pressure, a large committee of merchant adventurers and civic officials from London prepared articles to present to the Royal Council. And in these articles, they pointed out that while they were forbidden to trade with the Low Countries, the Hanse were, and were taking the lion's share of profit right now. And they asked that either the embargo be lifted from themselves or extended to everybody in England. I mean, they got another safe conduct from Flanders and Zeeland to show that they were willing to trade and Flanders was willing to take their trade. However, on the 18th of September 1493, the king reissued his embargo with the Low Countries. I mean, he did allow the merchant adventurers have £200 towards all the expenses that paid getting these safe conducts, but ultimately, things were to stay as they were. And that also meant that the Hanse were allowed to keep sailing. Henry said, you know, if you wanted to, you could put your goods on the Hanse ships. London was furious. And what happened next? Well, we have Grafton's account of what happened next. And while Grafton's account can always be suspected of being not always truthful, as it does take a very Tudor propagandist line, it does give us a compelling account into the events that followed in London. According to Grafton, the king, quote, not only banished all Flemish wares and merchandise out of his realm and dominions, but also restrained all English merchants from their traffic into any of the lands and territories of the King of the Romans and the Archduke his son, causing the market of merchandises and commodities of this realm to be kept at his town in Calais, unquote. Now, the King of the Romans was the title the English used to refer to the Holy Roman Emperor. And according to this, goods were not only being stored in the city of London, they were also being dumped in Calais. In retaliation to King Henry's move, however, Grafton says, quote, wherefore the said king and his son banished out of their lands all English cloths, yarn, tin, lead, and other commodities upon great forfeitures and penalties. The restraint made by the king sore grieved and hindered the merchants, being adventurers, for they, by force of this commandment, had no occupying to bear their charges and support their continuance and credit, unquote. So here, straight up, it's saying that because of this, the impact of the merchants and merchant adventurers was being diminished. They were feeling the price for this embargo. And yet, that was not the worst thing, because as Grafton goes on to say, quote, and yet one thing sore nipped their hearts, for the Easterling, which were at liberty, brought into the realm such wares as they were wont and accustomed to, and so secured their customers throughout the whole realm, unquote. So, right now, the Easterlings, another nickname, it means the Hanse merchants, were not only able to trade with Flanders, they were capitalising on the fact that for months no English ship had sailed and no English merchant was buying or selling a damn thing from Flanders. They were stealing England's customers, not just abroad, but at home as well. Quote, by reasons whereof, the masters, being destitute of sale and traffic, neither retained so many servants and apprentices as before they were accustomed, and in especial mercers, haberdashers and cloth workers, nor yet gave their servants so great a stipend and salary as before that their restraint they used to, unquote. So, we see in Grafton's account what was the direct impact of Henry VII's policies upon London. The merchant adventurers and other merchants could not maintain their servants and apprentices. There were layoffs in London. Young men who had seemingly thought they'd secured a future for themselves in stable households of rich merchants now found themselves cast adrift into the cold streets of the city. And we can see that all the guilds aligned with the merchants' adventurers, the cloth workers of all kinds, the haberdashers, the mercers, were having to cut the wages of those servants they retained. We can imagine the resentment towards the Hanse merchants in the steelyard right now. People were losing their jobs. Wages were being cut. And these foreigners were profiting? Well, the response should be no surprise, as Grafton goes on to relate, quote, "For which cause the said servants, intending to work their malice on the Easterlings, the Tuesday before St. Edward's Day, came unto the steelyard in London, and began to rifle and spoil such chambers and warehouses as they could get into, so that the Easterlings had much to do to withstand and repulse them out of their gates," unquote. And so we read that on Tuesday, the 9th of October, 1493, a riot started. It was sudden and dramatic, but clearly organised. A body of servants and poorer folk aligned to those professions clearly had gotten into the steelyard. They didn't fight their way in. The account starts with them being inside, looting and despoiling goods in storerooms and warehouses. Now, there were two ways into the steelyard from Thames Street. The rest of the compound was surrounded by high walls with very few windows. Based on German drawings of it at the time, there were these two ways in. First was a large gate, the main way into the steelyard. But further along Thames Street, there was a second way in, a narrow alleyway, presumably for deliveries. On one side of this alleyway was the council chambers of the Hanse merchants, and on the other side was a storehouse they used to sell wine from. Grafton specifically said the mob, quote, "spoiled chambers and warehouses," unquote. And that suggests to me that it was along this side alley the mob had gained entrance to the steelyard. And it was here that the Germans had to be able to push them back. Now, while I'm fairly sure the London rioters certainly had more people, the narrowness of the alleyway meant that the men inside the chambers and the warehouses would have quickly had to get out via the way they got in for fear of being trapped inside a sealed compound and suddenly found themselves outnumbered by angry Germans. And the mass of rioters couldn't have made their numbers count in such a confined space. So, for me, the most likely sequence of event is the riot had arrived seemingly out of nowhere. They had stormed the open side gate. They had begun rifling through the council chambers to their right and the wine warehouse to the left. The Hanse merchants, the Germans and their servants got organised and fought back. And then there was a fight, probably involving lots of blunt force trauma. But eventually, the Germans pushed them out of the alley and closed the gate. But that was not the end of things. Quote, "And when the gates were shut and made fast, the multitude rushed and beat the gates with clubs and longed to have entered. But the Easterlings, by the help of carpenters and smiths, which had come to their aid by water out of the borough of Southwark, had so strongly shored and fortified themselves that they could not prevail," unquote. So the riot continued and the Hanse held the mob off. It's worth saying that if we take Grafton's account as accurate, that this whole thing lasted for several hours, because it would have taken at least 15 or 20 minutes for any representative of the Hanse to get on a boat, get rowed across the river to Southwark, and then found some carpenters or smiths to help them, unless these guys were already on retainer, and then bring them back across to the steelyard in order to help them basically shore up the fences of the gates of the two ways in. But the impression I get is that this riot took a few hours to develop. It was an entire morning affair. But the news of this riot spread. And we read in Grafton's account that eventually, quote, "The mayor of London, hearing of this riot, assembled the magistrates and the officers of the city together, and being so furnished both with men and weapon, set forth towards the steelyard. As one at the coming of the mayor was declared and known to the riotous persons, they fled away like a flock of sheep. Albeit he apprehended divers of the malefactors and committed them to several prisons. And upon the inquiry before the king's commissioners, they were found guilty, about 29 servants and apprentices, and not one householder, which were confederate together to make this attempt. Some of the chieftains and beginnings of this mischievous riot were sent to the tower, and there long continued. But in conclusion, because none of their masters were found trespassers of this naughty act, the king in his goodness pardoned their offences and restored them to their liberty, unquote. This attack by the Londoners upon the Steelyard was effectively an international incident, not just a London affair, and the matter was kicked up to the Crown's authorities. And not surprisingly, the Mercers had come under suspicion as probable instigators of this. But they'd managed to offer the Lord Chancellor the time-honoured excuse that the riot was the, quote, simple dealing of young men, unquote. And that second part of Grafton's quote does suggest that London went all out to say that this was caused by just angry servants and apprentices, and none of the masters and taxpayers had anything to do with it. So here we are in 1493, and because of the king's policies over in Flanders, we're seeing a sudden riot erupt in London, and the fishmonger, Ralph Ashley, who was mayor that year, trying to sweep the entire thing under the carpet. And with this in mind, we return to our case of the Hanse merchant, who I'm saying is currently incarcerated in London's jails. Herman Ring. The events happened in the summer just before this, the summer of 1493. And the reason I put it there was because in that summer of 1493, there was massively increased tension in the city between the city and the Hanse merchant. It wasn't London's fault, it wasn't the Hanse merchant's fault. They were all just coping with the acts of great and powerful men. But still, the tensions are there. Tensions we know are about to explode into violence down on Thames Street, with mobs of Londoners trying to smash down the gates of the Steelyard. And this changes things. This adds a new dimension to the story. Now we know that there was a sense of resentment towards the Hanse merchants taking place in the city. So the first question we need to ask is simple. Did this tension actually drive why the jury found Herman Ring guilty of the crime he was accused? That it wasn't intimidation or bribery that turned the jury against him, but there was collusion. Maybe a sense of London wanting to lash out at the Hanse, and Herman was a convenient scapegoat. Maybe this is why the London judge delayed sentencing while he investigated the case some more. It could well be. But you see, there's another issue. Because we only have Herman's point of view of what happened, yes? And some of what he said does not ring completely true. And indeed, the moment we start looking at his account, we now start having additional questions. Take, for example, his explanation that it all started when he was just minding his own business, when Joan White approached him in the Steelyard. Immediately, we have a problem. We know from the detailed records of the Hanse merchants in the past, women were not allowed in the Steelyard. And unless she somehow made her way in via maybe the side gate, there is no way she should be in the Steelyard. Also, that way only leads to the council chambers and the wine storage site. Herman, by his own account, was somewhere else. So immediately, this suggests that either not only was Joan White a sex worker, and she was also a rather talented cat burglar and international woman of mystery, or Herman had invited her in, and that perhaps he knew she was a sex worker because he'd already purchased her favours. Understand who Herman Ring was. Ring was the son of a former mayor of Cologne. And as I said, he was being groomed for bigger things. He would go on to become a Cologne patrician and a part-time diplomat at the courts of Henry VII and Henry VIII. However, what was less well known was that Herman Ring had form. In the years previous, 1490 and 1491, Herman had been summoned to the Bishop of London's Commissary Court to answer charges of sexual misconduct towards London women. 4 times, with 4 different women. Herman seemed to like approaching London girls and propositioning them for sex. And given Joan White is already in the Steelyard when he starts his story, it does leave room to suggest that she was only there because he had enticed her there. I mean, we've got to ask, was she a sex worker? Well, we're not too sure. Joan White was not a unique name. In fact, living in London at this time, we have records of at least 3 other Joan Whites. One was named as the mother of an illegitimate child fathered by a man called William Smith, who lived out in Whitechapel in 1497. We also know that a Joan White appears as having her goods administrated, we assume after her death, by the parish of St. Mary le Strand, also in 1497. And interestingly enough, in 1494 we have a record of a Joan White who is living on Thames Street, where the steelyard was located. And she is named as a defendant in a defamation suit in the London courts. In truth, these could all be the same Joan White. As we follow her here in 1491, seemingly a sex worker, 3 years later she's involved in a case of defamation, and then 3 years after that, giving birth to an illegitimate child and then probably dying in the parish of St. Mary le Strand over near Westminster. That would tell us she had a hard life that was forever on the borders of legality. Or there could be four separate Joan Whites and none of them were related to each other. We can't say for sure, everyone can make up their own minds on that. What we can say is that there are reasonable grounds to have issues with Herman's account of things. He is a man accused of sexual misconduct before. So all we can say for sure is that Joan White was probably in the steelyard at his behest, and either he or one of his servants whipped her and she had to flee. And soon enough to make us wonder if she lived on Thames Street, her master Stephen Reigate turned up. And here's where the story gets even murkier, because according to Herman, Reigate was a pimp and a con man, but Stephen Reigate was many things, but he was never listed as a pimp. He was listed as a shipwright, and then he went on to become known as somebody who transported wine. And oddly enough, the competition for the sale of wine had become quite fierce in the late 1480s and 1490s in London. You see, while the English traditionally drank wine from Gascony, that market had taken a huge hit from during the Hundred Years' War, and it had never really recovered. And the English had begun to turn to other places for their sources of wine. The Hants were particularly partial to Rhenish wine, or Rhine wine, which was highly sought after in England. And the Hants had the right to sell Rhine wine from out of the steelyard. However, they refused to take part in London's fair sale practices, claiming immunity to the price-fixing policy instituted by the City of London over the price of wine in the 1480s. In retaliation, the Mayor of London at the time closed four Hansard wine cellars in the February of 1486, hoping to force them into accepting London's price of 10 pence per gallon of Rhenish wine. The Hants had appealed to the Royal Court and had them opened again. So there was tension between the Hants and the wine cellars of London anyway. And moreover, despite Henry VII's legislation that demanded all Gascon wine could only be imported into England and London on ships belonging to English subjects, by the August of 1490, there had been multiple confiscations from German-owned French wine freighted on Hansard ships. So, as well as issues over Hans trade to Flanders, there's long-running issues over Hans trade in wine from France. And this would have made Stephen Reigate someone who was known to them and them to him. Also remember, this anti-German attitude had manifested itself before the riot. Englishmen took it upon themselves to harass the increasingly unwelcome Germans. In 1490, a Hanseatic messenger had been assaulted on the road to Dover, while in the same year, a bunch of Cologne residents living in the steelyard had been attacked leaving church, leaving one mortally wounded. So this is going on in the background. This was the atmosphere that Herman Ring walked into when he pled not guilty to trespass. It has to be said, it could be that Reigate did have an axe to grind with him over wine importation. And there had been growing tensions and resentments from other aspects towards the steelyard. So maybe Herman was telling the truth when he said the case was rigged against him. But then again, given that he was perhaps importing illegal wine and that he was known as a sex pest, and the fact that half the jury had been foreigners, not from England and probably German, maybe this says that they actually believe the accusations against him. For me, I offer my conclusion to this tale, but says it's done with a large degree of speculation. I do think Joan White was a servant of Reigate, but he was not her pimp. I think she was an attractive woman who made money on the side with occasional sex work. I don't say this to condemn her. Sex work is always an avenue for the weak and dispossessed to survive in a society that is inherently cruel and harsh toward poor women, as Tudor London was. I think she was paid by Herman to sneak into the steelyard, and there, after spending some time with her, he got rid of her. He probably got rid of her because his fellow Hansers discovered her and said, "Herman, what are you doing with a lady in here?" I think he personally whipped her as part of an elaborate show to cover up his own misdeeds to his fellow Hansards. As such, I think Stephen Reigate had legitimate beef with Herman. I think maybe he did, as the alleged confession said, maybe pay Joan to dance naked or dressed in men's clothing for him. But there's no evidence that he needed to make money from her by being her pimp. And indeed, true or not, I think he would have taken full umbrage at Joan turning up being assaulted, especially by a bloody German wine cellar. And I think, while it could be argued either way, the mixed nature of the jury got it right and did indeed convict Herman, because simply they did not believe his fantastical account of events. And that's why he ended up in jail and why the judge wanted deeper investigation. But this was the London of an attempted attack upon the steelyard, and where after those riots, the mayor had to order London guards placed around the Stalhof for 7 days. Tensions were tangible, and probably why Herman wrote to the Chancellor asking him to deal with the case and not the City of London. We do not know if the Chancellor granted his appeal. We don't actually know anything more about the case. Maybe Joan was a sex worker who went on to find herself deframing some unknown man years later, and maybe then she gets pregnant, has an illegitimate child and dies. Or maybe she's just innocent and was the victim of a German sexual predator, and she only once engaged in prostitution after being propositioned by him. Maybe Stephen Reigate did indeed seek compensation for one of his working girls getting beaten. Or maybe he was outraged at some powerful German merchant attacking an innocent serving girl on his staff. And maybe all of this happened a few years before the 1493 riot outside the steelyard. All of these are legitimate questions, and for all my certainty, I remind the listener that my job is to craft the story, the needs of the narrator overriding the strictness of the historian. So I'm going to have the historian part in me leave those questions and then just conclude for myself. The story of Herman Ring, Joan White and Stephen Reigate plays out amidst a backdrop of a city in turmoil. There was increased passionate resentment towards the Hans merchants, who were protected and empowered, and while around them the residents of London, even the richer residents of London, were seeing their livelihoods crippled by the king's foreign policy requirements. London was desperately trying to navigate choppy geopolitical waters, and the slow-burn conflict between Henry VII and the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian and his family played out. Not for London academic descriptions of how such moves were taking place. For London, this entire nonsense with Perkin Warbeck meant apprentices losing their livelihoods, servants being fired, and others having their wages cut. It meant real hardships in a place where, as we described last chapter, life and prosperity hung on a knife's edge. London had become a powder keg, and in October 1493, it exploded in a riot that so could have easily become a massacre. As it was, the storm passed for now. But that odd little story of a sex-pest German merchant who would go on to be seeming all respectable, and the wine import and his female servant show how, for London, large things had small impacts. The mundane was linked to the epic. The affairs of court records of this city can only be understood, as ours are today, by knowing more about the context they took place in and the wider story of the world. The tale of the young man from Cologne teaches us that London was a place where the actions of kings and politics had an impact. That even the smallest action of the Tudor monarchs was already showing they could cause violence on its streets. And it shows how there existed even now in the early 1490s a gulf between the insular court of the first Tudor king and the powers that moved the largest of his cities. And this gulf was only going to grow, I'm afraid. And I'm going to leave it there. Thanks for listening. Story of London will return next week with another chapter. I'll see you then. This is Saul, hoping you are warm, safe, and looked after. Bye.